The food saved him. Of particular importance was the distinction between tortellini, small pasta stuffed with pork, and tortelloni, large pasta stuffed with ricotta cheese. The chef, upon realizing that Marco was a Canadian very curious about Bolognese cuisine, insisted on serving both dishes. As always, Luigi explained that both were exclusively the creations of the great chefs of Bologna. Marco simply ate, trying his best to devour the delicious servings while avoiding the Italian language. After 2 hours, Marco insisted on a break. He finished his second espresso and said goodbye. He left them in front of the restaurant and walked away, alone, his ears ringing and his head spinning from the workout. He made a 2-block loop off Via Rizzoli. Then he did it again to make sure no one was following. The long porticoed walkways were ideal for ducking and hiding. When they were thick with students again, he crossed Piazza Verdi, where the World Bank protest had yielded to a fiery speech that, for a moment, made Marco quite happy he could not understand Italian. He stopped at 22 Via Zamboni and once again looked at the massive wooden door that led to the law school. He walked through it and tried his best to appear as if this was his turf. No directory was in sight, but a student bulletin board advertised apartments, books, companionship, almost everything, it seemed, including a summer studies program at Wake Forest Law School. Through the hallway, the building yielded to an open courtyard where students were milling around, chatting on cell phones, smoking, waiting for classes. A stairway to his left caught his attention. He climbed to the third floor, where he finally located a directory of sorts. He understood the word Uffici and followed a corridor past 2 classrooms until he found the faculty offices. Most had names, a few did not. The last belonged to Rudolf Viscovich, so far the only non-Italian name in the building. Marco knocked, and no one answered. He twisted the knob, but the door was locked. He quickly removed from his coat pocket a sheet of paper he had taken from the Albergo Campiol in Treviso and scribbled a note. "Dear Rudolf, I was wandering around the campus, stumbled upon your office, and wanted to say hello. Maybe I'll catch you again at the Bar Fontana. Enjoyed our chat yesterday. Nice to hear English occasionally. Your Canadian friend, Marco Lazzari." He slid it under the door and walked down the stairs behind a group of students. Back on Via Zamboni, he drifted along with no particular destination in mind. He stopped for a gelato, then slowly made his way back to his hotel. His dark little room was too cold for a nap. He promised himself again that he would complain to his handler. Lunch had cost more than 3 nights' worth of his room. Surely Luigi and those above him could spring for a nicer place. He dragged himself back to Armano's cupboard-sized apartment for the afternoon session. Luigi waited patiently at Bologna Centrale for the nonstop Eurostar from Milano. The train station was relatively quiet, the lull before the 5 o'clock rush hour. At 3:35, precisely on schedule, the sleek bullet blew in for a quick stop, and Whitaker bounced off. Since Whitaker never smiled, they barely said hello. After a cursory handshake was complete, they walked to Luigi's Fiat. "How's our boy?" Whitaker asked as soon as he slammed the door. "Doing fine," Luigi said as he started the engine and drove away. "He's studying hard. There's not much else for him to do." "And he's staying close?" "Yes, he likes to walk around the city, but he's afraid to venture too far. Plus, he has no money." "Keep him broke. How's his Italian?" "He's learning rapidly." They were on the Via dell'Indipendenza, a wide avenue that was taking them directly south into the center of the city. "Very motivated." "Is he scared?" "I think so." "He's smart, and he's a manipulator, Luigi. Don't forget that. And because he's smart, he's also very frightened. He knows the danger. I told him about Kritz." "And?" "He was bewildered." "Did it scare him?" "Yes, I think so." "Who got Kritz?" "I'm assuming we did, but you never know. Is the safe house ready?" "Yes." "Good. Let's see Marco's apartment. Via Fondazza was a quiet residential street in the southeast section of the old city, a few blocks south of the university section. As in the rest of Bologna, the walkways on both sides of the street were covered with porticos. Doors to the homes and apartments opened directly onto the sidewalks. Most had building directories on brass plaques next to intercoms, but the one at 112 Via Fondazza did not. It was unmarked, and had been for the 3 years it had been leased to a mysterious businessman in Milan who paid the rent but seldom used it. Whitaker had not seen it in more than a year, not that it was much of an attraction. It was a simple apartment of about 600 square feet, four rooms with basic furnishings that cost 1,200 euros a month. It was a safe house, nothing more or less, one of three currently under his control in northern Italy. There were two bedrooms, a tiny kitchen, and a living area with a sofa, a desk, two leather chairs, no television. Luigi pointed to the phone and they discussed, in near-coded language, the bugging device that had been installed and could never be detected. There were two hidden mics in each room, powerful little collectors that missed no human sound. There were also two microscopic cameras, one hidden in a crack of an old tile high above the den, and from there it offered a view of the front door. The other was hidden in a cheap light fixture hanging from a kitchen wall with a clear view of the rear door. They would not be watching his bedroom, and Luigi said he was relieved by that. If Marco managed to find a woman willing to visit him, they could catch her coming and going with the camera in the den, and that was certainly enough for Luigi. If he got really bored, he could hit a switch and listen for fun. The safe house was bordered to the south by another apartment with a thick stone wall separating the two. Luigi was staying there, hiding next door in a five-room flat slightly larger than Marco's. His rear door opened into a small garden that could not be seen from the safe house, thus concealing his movements. His kitchen had been converted into a high-tech snooping room where he could switch on a camera anytime he wanted and take a look at what was happening next door. "Will they study here?" Whitaker asked. "Yes, I think it's secure enough. Plus, I can monitor things." Whitaker walked through each room again. When he had seen enough, he said, "Everything set up next door?" "Everything. I've spent the last two nights there. We're ready." "How soon can you move him?" "This afternoon." "Very well. Let's go see the boy." They walked north along Via Fondazza until it came to an end, then northwest along a wider avenue, Strada Maggiore. The rendezvous point was a small cafe called Lestre's. Luigi found a newspaper and sat alone at a table. Whitaker found another newspaper and sat nearby, each man ignoring the other. At precisely 4:30, Ermanno and his student stopped by for a quick espresso with Luigi. When the greetings were exchanged and the coats removed, Luigi asked, "Are you tired of Italian, Marco?"
"I'm sick of it," Marco replied with a smile.
"Good. Let's talk English."
"God bless you," Marco said.
Whitaker sat 5 feet away, partially hidden behind a newspaper, smoking a cigarette as if he had no interest in anyone around him. He, of course, knew of Ermanno, but had never actually seen him. Marco was another story. Whitaker had been in Washington for a stint at Langley a dozen or so years earlier, back when everyone knew the broker. He remembered Joel Backman as a political force who spent almost as much time cultivating his oversized image as he did representing his important clients. He'd been the epitome of money and power, the perfect fat cat who could bully and cajole and throw around enough money to get whatever he wanted. Amazing what 6 years in prison could do. He was very thin now, and looking quite European behind the Armani eyewear. He had the beginnings of a salt-and-pepper goatee. Whitaker was certain that virtually no one from back home could walk into Lestre's at that moment and identify Joel Backman. Marco caught the man 5 feet away, glancing over one time too often, but thought nothing of it. They were chatting in English, and perhaps few people did so, at Lestre's anyway. Nearer the university, one could hear several languages in every coffee shop. Ermanno excused himself after one espresso.
A few minutes later, Whitaker left.